Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome. I guess this is the beginning of our winter series of E-Team. A pleasure to see everybody. Just let me sort of apologize if anybody was a little bit confused about getting in, and just let me make it clear if I'm going in, because it's going to be with some of the other classes too. Basically, anybody who registered for our continuing classes, Rabbi Liebtag and Mark Shapiro, our Haftorah, Parshat HaShavua, are six classes that go on during the week. You do not have to re-register for those classes. However, the Zoom link is different, but just watch, you'll get an email like you always do a couple hours before the class. Just use that. If you did not, all our new courses, there's six of those also. The first one starting on Wednesday morning, Marty Lakshin, Parshanut and Polemics, and Thursday morning, Shuli Mishkin. Those, all of them, you have to re-register for. You have to register for each one. And the little confusion, when we first opened up the fall series in October, we did a thing where you could register once for all classes. We don't do that anymore. The system doesn't work as well. So anybody who registered for that, like the fall, they only registered once and they got in at the beginning, but we only have that for a few days. We'll have to re-register for this class also. So only if you specifically registered for Rabbi Liebtag or Lori Novick or Parshan, or the Haftorah part, then you don't have to re-register. So I hope that's clear. I will send out emails all week about that. And the basic thing is just to watch your email and use it. If you don't get an email, I can an hour and a half, 2 hours before the class, just re-register for the class you're interested in. I hope that clarifies, and I apologize if there's any inconvenience. I want to wish everybody, we look forward to a good year this year, secular year, Jewish year, whatever. It would be a good year, a year of good health. And thank you, Rabbi Liebtag. So we're in the middle, but we're starting fresh in the middle. So welcome, everybody, and thank you very much. And by now, everybody should be on. Okay, Vakasha.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi. You mentioned you're wishing everyone a happy secular new year. So we discussed this topic briefly, I think, in the second or third shir when we started. But I wanted to just get to Hanukkah because we were having classes before Hanukkah to get to the Hasmonean time period. Now we want to go back and do it properly with the what I call the missing years of the Second Temple period. And because this is the first class in 2021, I want to talk about the secular year, which we call 2021, in contrast to the Jewish year, 5781. Now, again, we talked about this briefly, and it was a bit confusing. It's one of the most confusing topics you'll ever see. I'm trying to do it today nice and organized and simple, so to have minimum confusion. On the other hand, it's a very controversial topic, so I have to do it very carefully. Just a word about dates in general. When do we use the Jewish date, like 5781? So someone mentioned before, my daughter was married on Sunday last week, and there's what's called a ksuba. And every wedding has a ksuba, like that's the official contract of marriage. And every contract, according to the Talmudic and Halachic guidelines, needs to have a date. And the date has to have not just the day of the month and the month, it also needs a year. And you need to use a year that everyone is familiar with. So our custom is what's called the Jewish year. We count to creation. We always say the minyan briat olam shanu monin. It's the first line of the ksuba. It's what year it is, and we count to creation. Now, if you were at a wedding about 2,000 years ago, and probably they had a ksuba, the date was not to creation. There was, as we'll see soon, the custom of dating Jewish events to creation is relatively new in Jewish history. It's a little over 1,000 years old. What was the earlier? We'll talk about earlier customs beforehand. But let me share my screen with everybody now. Share screen. And here's our topic for today. I want to clarify some concepts. The title today is The Missing Years of the Second Temple Period. And I want to clarify some concepts. Before we start, though, if you ask anybody, I should stop the share for 1 second, see everybody. Ask anyone, almost all of you, if I would ask you, what year was the first temple destroyed in secular years? Almost everyone would say 586. Agreed? Ask almost everybody, 586, it's everyone knows it. And ask everybody, how many years is it between the first temple and second temple period? They'll say 70. We had a whole class on that as well. And hence, the Second Temple period begins in minus 516. If it was destroyed in 586, it's a minus 516. Ask anybody, when was the second temple destroyed? Everyone knows what year? 70 AD. 70 AD, you might hear 69 or 68, but 70 is a pretty much given number. If we're going from minus 516 to plus 70, you know, depending on what you do with year zero, you're talking about 580 years of the Second Temple period. Ask any yeshiva student, or even almost any rabbi, how many years is the Second Temple period? They'll quote the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, they'll quote that, right? Like 420 without even flinching an eye. And I've seen timelines that have that show 420 years of the Second Temple period and beginning with minus 516 and ending in plus 70. And they think they can get away with it. Maybe I should, maybe next time I'll find, I collected a couple of those. And it's one of the most complicated things that people just like brush over. And there's no way to reconciliate them. We're not talking about 1 or 2 years. We're talking about what's called the missing years of Jewish history, or the Second Temple period. There's about 160 years missing. The goal this year today is to try to understand how that happened and why that happened. And on the one hand, to keep our faith in rabbinic tradition, at the same time, to be as true as possible to actual history. So now we go back to our, to do this properly, I'm going to go back and share my screen and have a nice little outline today. I call clarifying the concepts. Number one, a calendar, is it a tool or truth? Meaning what? When we say this is the year, we need a convention. Meaning because contracts, purchases, anything we do requires contracts and we need dates for running any type of society, any type of economy, needs a dating system. And we need a dating system that's viral, that everyone uses. And the more people that use it, the better. Therefore, when for example, nowadays, almost all of us, when we write checks or we write any document, we use the secular date, which is actually a Christian date, which they call AD, the year of their Lord. We call it CE, common era. But even though we're counting to a different God or a different religion, we use it not as a statement of faith, but rather because everyone else is using 2021, we use it. It's a convention. When we write those dates, it's not a statement of faith. Some people might not like doing it, might have second thoughts about it, but we almost have no choice. When you file your taxes, you're filing your taxes for, remember, 2021, 2020, for those who file. But we go by, we need a secular date because everyone uses it. But I'm saying it's not a statement of faith or truth. It's simply a tool that everyone uses as convention. Now, that's one concept. The other, when we study Tanakh and there's dates in Tanakh, are we reading Tanakh as a chronicle, meaning this is an historical book, here's what happened year by year? Or is it a prophetic composition? And if it's a prophetic composition, sometimes the Navi might use years, not necessarily as historical truth, but rather to make a point. I want to give you one little example, which is classic. We're going to open up the book of Shmuel. Let me stop this year. Chapter 13. There's a pasuk that cannot mean what it says. Let's open up a Tanakh. I'm sorry here. To the book of Shmuel. I'm sorry here. Samuel 1, chapter 13. Look at this opening line. Ben Shana Sha'oba Mecho. Translated means what? Look what they did in the English translation. They just left out how many years he was. It sounds like Shaul was 1 year old when he became king. Ushtei Shani Malach HaYisrael, he was king for 2 years. Now, clearly the author has left out how many years old he was. It should be maybe Ben Shloshim Shana. Like every other king, it says Ben Esrim Shana, Ben Esrim Chamesh Shana, something like that. For some reason, the author of Sefer Shmuel is purposely leaving out how old Shaul was when he became king, and also how many years he reigned for. When you study the book, he had to be king for at least way more than 2 years, probably closer to 10 or 15 years when you do the calculations. Nonetheless, this opening line is sort of called maybe obfuscating the years here. And if we were learning Sefer Shmuel, it would show you it's coming to make a prophetic point. Another example, in Sefer Shoftim, if I go back to Sefer Shoftim, I don't have to bring examples, I'm sure you remember. Almost every Shofet, if we go, for example, to chapter 3, the story of Otniel, Ben Kenaz, it just so happens that he was a Shofet, it was quiet for 40 years, during the time of Otniel. At the end of the chapter, we're told that there was 80 years of quiet. Here. Batikina Moabayamahu, Batishkot Arat Shmonim Shana. 80 years of quiet. If you remember the last line of Shirat Dvorah, that's the end of chapter 5. The last line of chapter Dvorah, what's it say? Batishkot Arat Arbaim Shana. So the first Shofet, 40 years of quiet. Then the next one, 80 years. And then another 40 years. And the same thing with Gidon, another 40 years. It's rather amazing coincidence that five Shoftim in a row, pretty much, they're either 40 years or multiple 40 years. Or it could be that 40 years in Tanakh, it's not an historical amount of years, but rather it's a time period based on, you know, the generation in the desert. It might even go back to the flood. For example, the number 40, when it comes to time, be it 40 days or 40 years, I call it a magic number in Tanakh. We have the flood, 40 days and 40 nights. We have Har Sinai, three sets of 40 days and 40 nights. We have 40 years in the desert, 40 years in Sefer Shoftim. What it means, I'm not sure of, but I highly doubt that those groups of 40 years are something historical. It might be 35, it might be whatever it is, but the Navi is using them to define something. What the meaning is, you could argue, but sometimes there's so much data that it can't be coincidental that everything's exactly 40 years. Now, something I said AD, I'll mention that. I'm saying they call it AD, the year of their Lord, on the deal, but we don't say that. We say CE, the common era. Very good. But they're saying, even though we use that, everyone else calls it AD, but we're not saying it as a statement of faith or truth, but rather we say it because it's a convention. Now, let's go back now to our... Now, when it comes to Midrash, and we'll be dealing with Midrash today, when a Midrash makes an historical statement, is it saying because the Midrash is omniscient, meaning it knows everything, it's a source of truth and historical truth? Or sometimes is a Midrash giving an example, giving historical data based on exegesis, meaning based on its understanding of the text and its study of the text? And that's another question when you study Midrash. How much is Midrash historical? How much is Midrash authoritative? And how much is it whoever wrote the Midrash is sharing their opinion with other people based on their own understanding of their own message you want to give over? Now we start a big topic. That was a stall for people coming in. Yeah, we hit 100, so now everyone's online. So at least 95% got the link. Now we start our topic. If you ask yourself, someone who studied the Bible, what dating system for years does the Bible use? One thing for sure, never in the entire Torah or Tanakh or Ketuvim, Torah, Nevim, Ketuvim, never is there an event or a date dated to creation. There's never an event with a date that says this event happened in this year of creation. Never found anywhere. In the story of the flood, if you might remember, the flood takes place year 600 in the life of Noah. It begins, remember, on the 17th day of the second month, and it ends in year 601 of the life of Noah. Now, if the Bible continued using the life of Noah as its reference point for years, that would be fine. But it only does that for the flood story. When Avram is chosen, it doesn't say that Avram was chosen in this year of the life of Noah. In fact, it doesn't say anything. It just says God picked Avram Avinu. And after the story of the flood, I'm pretty sure there's no event that's dated to a certain amount of time. The next time we find any type of dating system in the Torah is the story of the Exodus. And this is famous. Let's take a look in chapter 12 in the book of Shemot. We'll open up, if you have Tanakh with you, take a quick look. We'll share our screen. And we open up to Sefer Shemot. Sorry. Sefer Shemot chapter 12, right after we leave Egypt and we bake matzah. In fact, this pasuk in chapter 12, we say in our Seder. In verse 39, pasuk lametet. V'yafu et habatzeik. Remember, they took the dough that they took out of Egypt. They baked it matzah because they were rushed out of Egypt, thrown out, and they couldn't delay. Now, Pasuk Mem. In chapter 12, verse 40, Pasuk Mem. Umoshav b'nei Yisrael asher yeshvu b'mitzrayim. The time period where the people of Israel remained in Egypt, 30 shana v'arbamot shana, was 30 and 400 years. 430 years in Egypt. It didn't say what it's starting from. After 430 years, we left Egypt. Now, it's simple pshat. When would you start counting that from? What would be the simplest understanding of when we start counting the 430 years from? If it says the moshav, which means to dwell, to remain.
From when the time.
If you were in shul, okay,
when
maybe
Yaakov
came down to Egypt, remember Yosef invites them teshvu be'eretz Goshen, as a moshav, as a settlement in Egypt. We settled down in the second year of the famine. What year that was? It didn't say what year it was. How many years to Noach or anything? But if I'm counting 430 years, I would start counting from the time that Yosef is 37, I think, or when Yaakov is 130. That's for sure. Year 130 of Yaakov's life is when it would begin.
39, okay.
When he goes to far, when Yosef is 39 and Yaakov is 130. Because when he goes to Pharaoh, he says, how old are you? He says, I'm 130 years and my life's been miserable. That proves he was Jewish. Now, other than this pasuk, we don't have any other dating system. But the rabbis are going to argue, when we're counting from. In fact, the classic rabbinic opinion is we're counting from the time that Avram was 70 years old. We'll see. We'll deal with that later on. We talked about Seder Olam. But again, it's another example of lack of a dating system, because it would make more sense to say, Am Yisrael left Egypt in what year? In 2400 and something to creation. Or some year to life of Avram Avinu. All it tells you is that how many years Am Yisrael was in Egypt for. And later we have to give a thematic reason for this verse. But I'm just showing you, even where I would expect an official date, when I have a Be'etzem HaYom HaZeh, that's a critical event, that's an important event in Jewish history, Be'etzem HaYom HaZeh, on that very day, we don't have a date to Briat Olam. What system does Chumash use? Now we simply have to go to Sefer Bamidbar. In Sefer Bamidbar, the opening line, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe b'Midbar Sinai b'Hol Moed, Be'echad HaChodesh HaShini, God spoke to Moshe in Sinai Desert, on the first day of the second month, Bashana HaShenit, let's say Tam, Eretz Mitzrayim. Starting in Sefer Bamidbar, every event is dated to the Exodus, which makes sense because Jewish history begins with the Exodus. What I want to claim now for this part of this year, the most logical place to begin Jewish history, is if we had to choose a dating system for Jewish history, if it was up to us and we were picking our history, I would count from the Exodus. Or I could count from Har Sinai, which is the same year, isn't it? But since the months begin from the Exodus, that was chapter 12 in Shemot, HaChodesh Zem L'Chosh Chodeshim, we begin counting the months of the year from the Exodus. In fact, that's the first commandment we receive before the Exodus starts. That's chapter 12, Parsha HaChodesh. It makes sense also that the years start in Nisan from the Exodus in that year. And sure enough, that's what happens in Sefer Bamidbar. Another example, chapter 9 in Sefer Bamidbar. Actually, we're going backwards in history. We began with the second month, and now we go back to the first month. And we have that Am Yisrael bought Korban Pesach on the 14th day of the first month of the second year. If you go to the end of Sefer Bamidbar, another example, in chapter 33, we have a list of all the traveling. When the traveling's over, in verse 38, talks about the death of Aaron. Bayal Aaron akoina horahar, pi Hashem. Aaron goes up to horahar, and he dies there. When? Vishnat harbaim, let's say, b'nei sar meretz Mitzrayim, in year 40 of the Exodus. And then sure enough, in Sefer, if we just go one more book, open up Sefer Devarim. You don't have to go very far. Sefer Devarim begins with the opening line. And now what's it say in verse 3? Okay, in chapter 1 in Devarim. Vahi b'arbaim shana came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the 11th month. God spoke to Moshe, everything that God had commanded him. And that's pretty much, that's the date of the majority of Sefer Bamidbar. Moshe's speeches begin on Rosh Chodesh, and then we can do a calculation that he dies on the 7th of Adar, about a month and 7 days later. So all I'm trying to show you now is that in the book, in the Torah, There's only one dating system which makes perfect sense. That's counting to the Exodus. Soon you see why I'm making such a big deal about this. The book of Yeshua, if we had time, we could read and scan the whole book. We don't need to, because there are no dates in the book of Yeshua to any year. We have lots of dates, but there's no continuous chronology in the book. In fact, it's hard to do a calculation of all the years. The rabbis have a calculation, 7 years of conquest, 7 years of settling, based on something that Yeshua says in Kalev, about I'm strongest before and things like that. But there's many opportunities to give a date, no dating, no, not to creation, not to anything. Sefer Shoftim, again, no dating at all, no date to creation, no date to even Yitzhak Mitzrayim, rather, many dates of 40, groups of 40 years and some other things as well. But again, no, there's so many opportunities. If this is a book of you know, of our Jewish heritage, where if there was a custom of dating to creation, I should write it. It doesn't write it. Same thing in the book of Shmuel. No dates to any event. Actually, there's in Shmuel in chapter 7, it says after 20 years of repentance, Shmuel gathers the people for a gathering, but didn't say in what year that took place. It says 20 years had passed of people repenting in chapter 7 in the beginning, in Shmuel Aleph. Now, there's one anchor, which is key. In the book of Kings, in Sefer Melachim, in the book of Kings, at a very key event in Jewish history, get the mute, okay, thanks. Chapter 6, and I think in a key event in Jewish history, when the first temple is completed, that's when we build the first temple. What are we told? Vahi bishmonim shana varbamot shana. It took place in year 80 and 400. You have to do the math on your own. That's a total of 480. Let's say bnei Yisrael eretz Mitzrayim. We finally find one more date in Tanakh, dating to the Exodus. A very key event. Remember, in the fourth year of Shlomo's reign, when he begins construction of the second temple. And then he talks about how he built the temple. What do we have here? We have a seminal date. Again, year 80 and 400 from the time of Egypt. We see we're counting to the Exodus, not to creation. And the year is really sort of suspicious, isn't it? Because what year is it? 480 has two magic numbers in it. It's 40 times 12. Again, that could be just an amazing coincidence. Or it could be the fact that the temple was built in year 480, which is actually 80 and 400. Which is, we have the number 400 again. Remember we had the number 400? Very similar. When we left Egypt, it was 30 and 400 years. Now it's 80 and 400 years. There seems to be, for some reason, this idea of 400 years, similar to groups of 40 years in Sefer Shoftim. It could be the numbers of what's called typological, or it could be they're historical. I'm not doubting they're historical, but if someone wants to suggest maybe it's not historical, there's definitely reason to think there's something typological about these numbers. But we have an anchor now, 480 years from the time of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and another example of counting to the Exodus and not counting to creation. From here on in Sefer Shoftim and Sefer Melachim, everyone's familiar, we count to the kings. And that was a custom in every country in the time. Everyone counted to their kings. No one, until the Greeks, no one counted a continuous history. No one had a year one and started counting up. Not that we're aware of. Rather, what do we find in almost every in every society or every dynasty, in every kingdom, be it in Egypt, be it in Mesopotamia, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, everyone's counting to their kings. And hence, they have to have a list of kings, the order in which they reigned, and how many years every king reigned for. And there's no doubt the author of Sefer Melachim has in front of him what's called the Book of Chronicles of the Kings of Yehuda and the Book of Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. And when Yirmiyahu puts together Sefer Melachim and does his final, I guess, prophetic redaction of the book, he's quoting from that the Chronicles of the Kings of Yehuda and the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel to let you know what the official name of the king was, how many years he reigned for, the name of the mother, etc. We find that all through Sefer Melachim. But there's never another date to the Exodus, but rather we can calculate how many years passed through the book because we know how many years every king reigned for until the temple was destroyed. We open up the Second Temple period. What do we find? We're no longer counting to the Jewish kings. We're counting to the Babylonian kings and then to the Persian kings because we're under their rule. Now, there's one verse you should be aware of, which is nice for trivia, which almost all biblical dating is anchored on this verse. In the book of Yirmiyahu, let's find Jeremiah here, Yirmiyahu chapter 25, the very first verse. This is an anchor for all biblical dating. Why? Hadavar hasher hayahu Yirmiyahu ko am Yehuda b'shana harivit lo Yehoyakim ben Yoshiyahu melech Yehuda. Here's an event to the year 4 of King Yehoyakim, the king of Judah. He hashana rishonit Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. The fourth year of King Yehoyakim is the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Bavel. The first year we'll see that he reigns over the Babylonian Empire and takes over the Assyrians and takes over Nineveh, etc., a couple years beforehand. Now, since we know from other sources, Nebuchadnezzar is mentioned in numerous Babylonian sources, and Persians talk about him as well, because that's well known, if I want to link the Jewish dating system and the Tanakh, or Sefer Melachim, to outside history, this is the anchor for all dating. That's a bit of trivia that's good to know. Now, in all of our classes till now of the Second Temple period, we had Koresh, the first year of Koresh in the book of Ezra. The book of Ezra counts the years of Koresh to Daryavesh, Tartakshasta. The book of Haggai to Daryavesh, the book of Zechariah to Daryavesh. We saw all those years. That was clear. We're never counting. We have many opportunities to say what year it was of creation. Never is that ever mentioned. I hope my point's clear. Meaning, in the entire Tanakh, with numerous opportunities to have what year it was to creation, is never mentioned. If we do mention anything continuous, it's to the Exodus, but we only have that in the book of Kings. We have that in Chumash, Sefer Bamidbar and Devarim, and the book of Kings. Instead, we find dating to the years of the Jewish kings, and then when there's no longer Jewish sovereignty, we start counting to the Persian kings. What happens in the Second Temple period? Okay, so our Second Temple period, we had Darius, we had Artaxasta, we had the kings we're familiar with. Tanakh ends, the last event in Tanakh that's recorded is year 34 of Artaxasta. We'll return to that later on. We have no more dates in Tanakh, nothing to go back to, but it doesn't say what year it was again from creation. After the Persian time period, the Greeks defeat the Persians. Everyone knows who does that. That's Alexander the Great. We do know from outside history that the Greeks came up with a new dating system. Unlike the Persians or anyone beforehand, the Greeks, who had this big empire, they come up with a great chop. They come up with a great idea. Instead of counting to our kings and making everything confusing because there's lots of different Greek kings simultaneously. Remember, the Greek empire divides between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria and Greece itself. Because they're overlapping kings in different kingdoms, they decide, but we're one big Hellenistic people, they decide to count the Hellenistic year, what's called the Seleucid year, which coincides with either minus 311 or 312 BCE. We won't worry about the single years, but we'll call it 312 for the sake of our share. During Greek time, that's the year everyone used, and the Romans continued that dating system. When the Romans defeated the Greeks, they simply took the Hellenistic year and continued, and that year continued all through the Second Temple period and into the time of the Tanaim. Which means during the time of Chazal, during the time of the Tanaim, the second the Mishnah begins, and we have Tanaim, which starts with Alexander the Great, Shimon HaTzadik met Alexander the Great. We're familiar with that from our tradition. It means the rabbis are living during a Greek time period, and because the rabbis have contracts, and there's Masechet Sanhedrin about writing contracts, and you have to have a year, the date that the rabbis used in all their dating, in all their contracts, was not a date to creation, nor a date to a Jewish king, nor a date to the Exodus. It was rather the Greek date. Why? I'll say half in jest. It was free, but seriously, it was viral. Meaning, I need a year, again, not as a statement of faith, I need a year that everyone accepts and everyone uses. Because we're living under Greek rule, and there's tremendous Hellenistic influence over the Jews, that we know. We know from the Jewish names, remember Antigonus, the name Sanhedrin, and things like that. There's tremendous Greek influence for good or for bad. And don't be surprised that the Jews accept the Greek year, the same reason that we accept the secular year. When we write our checks, we write 2021, because everyone else is using it. Now I'm going to suggest something. I'm going to suggest I have no proof other than, I think, common sense. I'm assuming that sometime during the time of the Tanaim, someone came up with a great idea. I call it, wouldn't it be nice? If you know that song from way back, I forget where it's from. But everyone knows the thing, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice if the Greek here that everyone is using also had Jewish significance? Meaning, ideally, we don't have a Jewish king. We can't count to a Jewish king. There's no Greek king to count to either. The Greeks are counting to their year. But if we could, we would much rather count to the Exodus. The problem is no one else is counting to the Exodus. But wouldn't it be nice if the Greek year somehow was in sync with the Jewish year counting to the Exodus? Why would that be nice? Ideally, I should count to the Exodus. That's what Chumash does. That's what we have examples of that in Tanakh. And the Exodus is not just the time of the Exodus. We become a nation then. It's our nationhood. It's also the Torah being given. So if we could count to the Exodus, it would be great. But we can't because we're counting the Greek year. But if the Greek year was in sync with the Exodus, wouldn't it be nice? Now, understand my assumption? So let's say, you know, you're bored one day and you want to see, could it possibly work? Here's what I want to do. I want to follow the thought process, which I think happened sometime during the Second Temple period, using Tanakh as our source. And it's real easy. Let's go back to our source sheet and I'll show you how simple it is. Where are we? Here's our source sheet. We brought those examples. If we calculate the years, what did we find so far? Year one of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Remember, the Exodus is year one. We have the source, Bamidbar, the first line of Sefer Bamidbar. We count to the Exodus. Our second source was, let me highlight this real fast. We can annotate and we can use a little spotlight. Here we go. We build the first temple. We saw that verse in the book of Kings, chapter 6, verse 1. It's 480 till the time they build the first temple. Okay, I'm trying, what I want to do, I want to calculate the years from the Exodus to the end of Tanakh. Because if I want to hear, how many years are there in the Tanakh? From the time we leave Egypt till Tanakh ends, it's very easy to calculate. Why? It's 480 till the first temple is built. Until the second temple, first temple is destroyed, I can calculate the years based on the book of Kings. It doesn't say it, but there's 19 kings in the book of Kings. I add up all the years, I get to 428. But the first year of every king is also the last year of the previous king. So if one king is 28 years, the next king is 22 years, then it's not a total of 50 years, it's a total of 49 years, because the first year of one king is the last year of the previous king. Because we increment the year, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. A king could, let's say, is coronated, let's say in Adar, in the 12th month. A month later, in the month of Nisan, it's already the second year of his reign. That was the convention. Masechet Rosh Hashanah talks about that. Remember, the Rosh Hashanah for kings is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which means every Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the next Jewish year of the next king. Therefore, that's how they get to 410 years of the Second Temple period. It's in the Gemara. It's very easy to calculate. It's easy done. In our study, we saw in the book of Zechariah, maybe we'll take a quick look at it. Let me show you how it's a pasuk. Let's open up our Tanakh again. Open up the book of Zechariah, which we've seen many times. And in the book of Zechariah, what do we see here? It's funny. We want Zechariah. There you go. In chapter 1, it's the second year of Daryavesh. Chapter 1 of Zechariah. It's the second year of Daryavesh. He has a vision. And on the 24th day of the 11th month, in the second year of Daryavesh, he has another vision. And in that vision, what does he say? He has this malach of God speaking. Vayan malach Hashem v'yomar, Hashem tzvot, ad matai ata lo terachem et Yerushalayim v'et Arei Yehuda asher z'am tezeh 70 shana. Isn't it time already to have mercy on Jerusalem? Your anger has been kindled against it for the last 70 years. Now we know from Haggai that they broke ground on the temple in the second year of Daryavesh. We spent a lot of all of our Hanukkah shurim were built on that. Year two of Daryavesh, they break ground on the second temple. Will it really last? Will it really be filled? That's what the Navi is praying for here in this vision of Zechariah. And now we know that it's been 70 years from the time the temple was destroyed in the 11th year of Tzidkiyahu until the second year of Daryavesh. So I don't need to get into anything complicated. All I need to do now is take this date and add it to my table. What do we have? It's 70 years from the time the first temple was destroyed to the second year of Daryavesh. Agreed? 70. Okay. Now it gets complicated. Now it's, we're up to year 960. It was the they break ground on the second temple, year 960 of Yetzet Mitzrayim. We're getting close to the year 1000, aren't we? Now I'm stuck. I mentioned before, that's why we dedicated the whole share last week to exactly this question. What happens between year 6 and year 7 in the book of Ezra? What do we find? In the book of Ezra, I'm purposely not putting this on the list. I'm going to go back to the share we did last week. Not this one, here we go. In the book of Ezra, remember we talked about a gap between Koresh and Dayavesh. It's not important for our share because we have year 2 of Dayavesh as a benchmark. That was in the book of Ezra, chapter 4. They stopped building from Koresh to Dayavesh. In year 6 of Dayavesh, that's Ezra chapter 6, they completed construction of the second temple that we read. Then there was a gap. The entire share last week, I spent so much time on it, that there's a gap between year 6 of Dayavesh and year 7 of Artaxasta, which is the gap between year 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. That gap is important because that gap, what happened in that gap? Now, if there is a gap, and I follow outside history, then I'm over 1,000. It's too late. But if I make this bold assumption that what? If I say that Dayavesh is Artaxasta, which is a rabbinic opinion we'll see in Seder Olam, if I say it's the same king, then there is no gap if Dayavesh is Artaxasta. Got it? And then I have continuous history. Now, why the book of Ezra skips it, we're going to dedicate lots of time on that. There's prophetic reasons, thematic reasons, lots of good reasons why the book skips that time period. But if I take that bold assumption that there is no gap, and Dayavis is Artaxasta, then the last event in Tanakh is year 34 of Artaxasta, which is 34 of Dayavish. Is that clear? And hence, I have an easy solution now. Let's go back to our table. Let's go back to our little table over here. What do we have? Didn't have to move anything. I have from year 2 of Dayavesh to year 34 of Artaxasta, who is Dayavesh? Remember, if Darius is Artaxasta, and in the book of Nehemiah, we have year 32 and he comes back 2 years later, we have 34 years. The last year of Tanakh is 993. Got it? From year 2 of Dayavesh till year 34 of Dayavesh. 33 years elapse, or year 993. According to Chazal, this is out of nowhere. You follow? If I assume that Darius is Artaxerxes, if Dayavesh is Artaxasta, then the last year of Tanakh is 993. We're really close to 1,000, aren't we? The rabbis come up with a bold statement. What do they say? In Seder Olam, next year we'll dedicate to Seder Olam. We'll do Seder Olam properly and see what Seder Olam is up to. But in Seder Olam, which is the work of Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta, a famous Tana, it's Sam Rabbi Yossi, it's Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta, and Seder Olam, its final form is attributed to him, and we're talking about 2nd century CE, or the 4th generation of Tanaim. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta is a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva, and he's the Rebbe of Rabbi Yossi, of the Mishnah, of Rabbi Yudah Nasi. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chalafta is the link between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yudah Nasi. He's famous, Rabbi Yossi. Now, he was from Tzipori, if you know Israel, and things like that, and he moves later to Bavel for good reasons. Now, he's under the Hadrian persecutions, if you know that stuff, which will help understand Seder Olam as well, but we'll dedicate a whole share to that. If that assumption is right, the Tanakh ends in year 993, if Dayavesh Artaxasta, then all we need is 6 years between Tanakh ending and Minyan Shtarot to solve our problem. So the rabbis come up with this great assumption that what? Based on what I call wishful thinking, wouldn't it be nice? That 6 years pass from the year the Tanakh ends. In fact, Chazal say the year the Tanakh ended, the year after Tanakh ended, is Alexander the Great comes and conquers Elam. Now, everyone knows from Herodotus and from Greek sources that Alexander the Great killed a king named Darius. He's called Darius III. Now, if our Artaxasta is Darius, got it? If Darius is Artaxasta and there's only one Darius, then who's Darius III? None other than Artaxasta. Now, this assumption, if you know your outside history, doesn't begin. But that's what Seder Olam is going to do. It's going to say that the year after Tanakh ends is when Alexander the Great came and conquered Elam. And 6 years later, he conquers the rest of the Persian Empire, Parasumadai. And they say Binyan Shtarot begins at the end of the conquest of Alexander the Great, even before he died. That's not historically true. We know from outside history it started 8 years after his death. Not to mind the Sripta, but that's not for now. Instead, Olam, again, I'm going based on wishful thinking. Gemara Avodah Zarah talks about it. We'll do that next year properly. All you have to say is that in our tradition, the Greek year begins 6 years afterwards. Then the Greek year becomes 1,000 Tzitzat Mitzrayim. Got it? Now, what do we gain by that? We gain something beautiful, which I think makes a lot of sense. I'm not saying they have to say that. All I want to say, there's logic. There's very good, solid logic for a Midrashic approach whose goal is to turn the Greek year into Jewish year and to turn the Greek year into a meaningful Jewish year. Every time a Jew in the time of the Tanaim writes a star or whatever it might be, writes a date and uses a Greek date, in essence, what does he need to do? Cross his fingers and add one day, or what the Gemara calls add alpha. Add 1,000 to the Greek date and you have a Jewish date. And instead of counting to the Greek year, we're simply counting to Yitzhak Mitzrayim, just drop the thousands. Now, we all know our year is Tavshin Pei Hei. No, it's not. It's Hei Tavshin Pei Hei. But no one writes Hei Tavshin Pei Hei. We just write Pei Aleph. Why? Because no one counts the thousands because we don't live that long. We're always staying within the millennium. It's like in our days, we write 20, remember? 20 or 22, we don't even write the 2000. You know, if you're looking for your best music, you want 60s music or 70s music, no one says, I'm looking for 1960s. I'm looking for the 60s. The same thing here. In that way, during the time of the Tanaim, it's year 200, 300. Remember the story of the Maccabees is 148 to Minyan Shtarot. The book of Maccabees, which is a religious book, we spent time on that, didn't we? The author was a from Jew. He uses the Greek year. Everyone's using the Greek year. The Gemara talks about it. And therefore, the Greek year simply becomes the Jewish year, Tzitzat Mitzrayim, if I add the year 1,000, if I follow this calculation, which I call wishful thinking. In my opinion, when the rabbis did this, no one took this historically. No one thought for a minute this is historical truth. Rather, it's an exercise, you follow? It's a beautiful midrash. That's why I said midrash. Sometimes it's not historical, but it's thematic. Now, watch how simple it is to get to our year. And I see my time's almost up, so let me finish. Oh, no, I have 15 minutes. I forgot where we have the extra. I thought I was running out of time. I'm not. Let's see how simple it is, how we get to our year. I want to keep it as simple as possible. Okay. Again, based on this tradition, I simply want to do it nice and clear, the way I understand what the rabbis did. Again, I don't have the historical text and say, here's what the rabbis did. I'm just saying, if I was living at that time period, I would really understand why a rabbi would come up with this approach. Because the goal is to turn the Greek year into a Jewish year. It's something nice to do. Do you have to do that? No, but it's a logical thing to do. And to do that, I have to say Darius is Artaxerxes. That's assumption number one. And I have to say that after Tanakh ends, there's only 6 years between then and when the Greek year begins. Two bold assumptions that have no basis in real history. But they're, I call wishful thinking. Now, if that's the case, what's the Greek year today? Okay, so the Jewish year begins, the Greek year begins 1,000 after the Exodus. Now, we know that the Greek year began in minus 312. That's well known, 311, 312. We'll just go with 312. Therefore, today's Greek year, how do I get to Greek year today? 2021 and 312, or the Greek year today is 2333. And what's interesting, if I want to know what is the year today since the Exodus, based on this, today, this year now is 3333 since the Exodus. Make sense? Nice and simple? Now, in my yeshiva in Har Etzion, there's a Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Meidan, and he began a custom several years ago. When he writes the date, he uses the date, this date. His source sheets for Shir Kali. And he writes a letter. He wants to start a trend for nice reasons. He's used this year. This year is 3,333 Tzitzat Mitzrayim. Ask anyone in yeshiva if you have any gushka, you see Rav Meidan. That's what he does. Now, if that's true, so what's the year today? How do I turn this to our year? Well, it's real simple. if the Exodus took place in 3333, it's 3,330 years since the Exodus. What year was the Exodus since creation? Now, we'll do this calculation later, but everyone knows that Exodus took place, according to the rabbis, in 2448. What's the calculation? We'll do the calculation in a minute. But if I assume that the Exodus took place in 2448, remember Avraham Avinu was born in 1948? We'll do that calculation soon. Avram was 100 when Yitzhak was born. And assuming that from the time Yitzhak was born until we left Egypt was 400 years, which also is not pshat, but that's what Seder Olam is going to say, then the Exodus takes place in 2448. If I take from creation to Exodus is 2448, and since the Exodus it's 3333, add them up and what do you get? 5781. Now, why is that interesting? It's interesting because everyone uses this year, correct? Everyone knows that's the Jewish year. What people don't realize is that year is based on what? Based on these Midrashic assumptions. If I really claim that the year is 5781 since creation, then I'm claiming that Darius is our Takshasta and that Tanakh ended a year before Alexander the Great took over Elam and 6 years before he took over, conquered all of Persia. Assumptions which have almost no historical basis at all, other than the rabbinic wishful thinking. Now, I don't think that, I'm not calling this date wrong. I'm not saying it's not a true, it could be by chance, it happens to be that we're missing years, you know, it could be it overlaps. But there's no tradition of counting 5781 to about 1,000 years ago. Why? Because the rabbinic tradition was always to count to Yitzhak Mitzrayim. I mean, to Minyan Shtarot, which is Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Now, when everyone else on the globe was counting Tzitzet Mitzrayim, so were we. But once the Jewish people moved to Europe and were living in Christian Europe, no one is using the Greek year anymore. And therefore, we can't use the Greek year. Everyone's using the Christian year. By the 8th, 9th, 10th century, everyone's using in Europe, everyone's using the Christian year. And we have to use it also, but we can't use it. Well, maybe you can use it writing a check. But if I'm having a wedding, I'm not going to write it on my ksuba. I can get away with the Greek year. Why? Because it's also Tzitzet Mitzrayim. But I can't put the year of their Lord on a tomb, on a matseva, on a Jewish grave tombstone. I'm not going to put it on a Jewish document. So what should I do? I have several options. I can keep using the Greek year. But if I do that, I'm keeping Greek culture going. What are we celebrating Hanukkah that we defeated Greek culture? Why keep up a Greek custom? What could I do? I could add 1,000 and count Tzitzet Mitzrayim. But since we always drop the thousands, in essence, I haven't changed a thing. Again, we could have done that. I'm saying, what custom happened instead? I didn't say they have to, but that's what they did. What did they do? They don't want to use the Greek year anymore. Adding 1,000 wouldn't change anything. And therefore, they came up with a new idea. Let's take the Greek year, add 3448 to the Greek year, which is 1,000, you know, of Yitzhak Mitzrayim and how many years it was to Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and use that and count to creation. They count to their testament, we count to our testament, we count to our creation. And that became a Jewish custom, which made a lot of sense. And ever since, around the 9th, 10th century, all the Jews are counting to there. Now, there are some inscriptions in the Second Temple period, like in Susia, the Shul in Susia, if you've been there, I think it's from like 6th century, that there's a floor stone that has a date to creation. We don't have the exact date because half of it's missing, but it's definitely date to Briat Olam there, which means there was a custom already counting of, you know, in monuments counting to creation. So we see it began because Seder Olam had already caught on. It only begins end of the Gonim. And
Rabbi, we lost you for like 45 seconds. Rabbi, your feed went down.
I'm back on.
Right, so we lost last, you know, 45 seconds or so. That's
okay,
it.
So let me just repeat that real fast.
Okay.
We find in Susia, if you've been to Susia, there's a show in Susia. On the floor of the Shul in Susi, at the entrance, there's a stone there on the floor with the dedication of, you know, who dedicated the shul and things like that. And there's a date of when the shul was built. And the date is to creation. People are counting to creation. The custom began, but nothing from beforehand. It makes sense that after a while they start, you know, using that. Once you have Seder Olam, which is our topic for next week, we'll understand why they did that. What I'm trying to show you is that our year, our custom of counting, and what I'm assuming is once we stop using the Greek year, we decide we don't add 1,000 to go to Yitzhak Mitzrayim because in essence, we haven't changed anything. Once everyone's using the Christian year, then we have to change our year to make something more significant. And how do I take the Greek year and turn it into a year to creation? I have to add 1,000 to Yitzhak Mitzrayim and 2448 from the time of Yitzhak Mitzrayim to the birth of Avraham Avinu. Now, how we get to that calculation, I don't think we have time to do it today. We'll do it properly when we do Seder Olam. So that's why we get across today. Let me just do here. Here's the calculation to 2448. I'll just go over quickly because it's on the source sheet, which I'll share with you soon. Let me just clear the the drawings. There we go. In creation, of course, is day one. Avram is born in 1948. That's based on the genealogies in chapter 5 and chapter 11. In chapter 5, I have the genealogies year by year, from Adam to Noah, or actually till Shem. And in chapter 11, I have the genealogies from Shem until Terach, and then Avram Avinu. And I can calculate that Avram was born in 1948. Now, it's a cute coincidence, isn't it? It's 1948. But that's just by chance. Then Yitzhak was born 100 years later. That's a pasuk in Breshit. We read on Rosh Hashanah. Avram ben Matshana bivadai lo Yitzhak beno. That we know. And then how many years is it from the birth of Yitzhak to the Exodus? That the minimum amount is 400 years. In Peshat, it's way more, isn't it? We saw that before. If the 430 is from the time Yaakov goes down to Egypt, I have to add in about, it's more like 550 years from the time of the birth of Yitzchak till we leave Egypt. But the minimum opinion is 400 because of Brit Ben Abtarim. That's the minimum approach. That's a topic in Seder Olam. But therefore, there's no less than 2448. So you're asking if I say the year is 5781 now, it's assuming it's only 400 years from the birth of Yitzhak to the Exodus, which is really minimal and not Pshat and Chumash at all. Pshat and Chumash is 430 from the time that Yaakov and family goes down to Egypt. And if I don't take the Midrashic assumption of the Second Temple period, I'm missing another 160 years. So we're talking about some 250 years ahead. We're way past the year 6,000. But you can do whatever you want. Now, it could be that we have too many years somewhere else. But again, I'm just trying to explain to you where that custom came from. Now, again, just want to summarize again. Our calculation is based on what assumptions. The Yitzhak Mitzrayim was 400 years from the birth of Yitzhak, based on Brit Ben Abtarim, but not going to Shemot. And again, that's a minimal assumption, that there's no gap between Ezra chapter 6 and 7. That was last week's share. And David Takshasa, that's also an assumption which isn't Pshat. And the Tanakh ends, the year the Tanakh ends, Alexander the Great comes and takes over. That's also an assumption which without any real historical basis. Which means our year is a Midrashic interpretation. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, the problem is, when we'll study Seder Olam and see how they develop that. The problem is, once we accept 5781 as a Jewish year and we put it in all of our documents, then all the Midrashic interpretation that led to that conclusion de facto became Jewish history because it gets too complicated. Let me stop my share for a minute because I think, the rest is... Seder Olam, I'll have to do this next week. You know what? I'll get sources for Seder Olam and why the rabbis use it. But I'll stop the share here and we'll take questions. What I'm trying to explain... I'll get the record. Okay, if you want... Okay, I'll get to the things in the thing in a minute. I'll get to the text and I'll get to the chat in a second. What I want to claim is to keep our faith, pretty much. What I want to say is we have a rabbinic tradition that the year is 5781. The goal of this year was to show you that rabbinic tradition is based on logic and wishful thinking, but don't take it as historical truth. Why? Because when I match up the history, it doesn't match up. That doesn't mean the rabbis are wrong or they made a mistake. The rabbis had a different approach to history. And I'm going to give additional reasons when we study Seder Olam, why they're crunching the years. There'll be thematic reasons, not just wishful thinking reasons, of why they crunch the years of Bayit Sheni, which will relate to everything we talked about. And that'll take us back to the Nevuot of Zechariah and Malachi and God's expectation from the Jews. That'll be already a class in Zionism and an understanding of Megillat Esther. Also, I'm trying to show you, if you're an Orthodox Jew, appreciating Chazal and having faith in Chazal, but also studying outside history, and how do you reconcile the obvious contradiction between the Second Temple period being 420 years, which is the Seder Olam, the rabbinic approach, which we just saw based on those two assumptions, or how does that fit with outside history, which doesn't match at all? If I understand why the rabbis crunched the dates, when I understand why the rabbis crunched the history and crunched the years for thematic reasons, for ideological reasons, whatever it might be, then there's no longer a contradiction. It's not that the rabbis are wrong. The rabbis have a different way of looking at history for different reasons. But you don't have to, because what happens? When you teach this to 18-year-olds, which I get in trouble for all the time, where they go, oh, the rabbis are wrong. If they're wrong about this, they're wrong about halacha also. So you give them another reason. They have plenty of reasons why not to keep halacha. But the second you prove that the rabbis are wrong in something, oh, they say, oh, the rabbis are wrong. They're wrong about halacha as well. And I can pick and choose and become what we call modern Orthodox. And that's a disaster. I'm trying to show you, I'm trying to give a logical reason why this became rabbinic tradition. Again, because and then for hundreds of years, probably over 1,000 years, this became rabbinic tradition based on this, what I call wishful thinking, to make the Jewish year meaningful, make the Greek year a Jewish year. But once it caught on and became accepted year, then all the Midrashic interpretation that led to that conclusion de facto became real Jewish history, which will affect who Ahasuerus was in the Megillah. It'll affect tons of things. It'll affect our calculation of when the Shemitah years and things like that. It'll have tremendous effects. And for educational reasons, it's called keep it simple. They just taught it like it's history. Because it wasn't a cover-up. It was too complicated to teach. I'm trying to explain how it came about and how it's reconciled. Plenty of people have come up. It's a famous topic. There's books on it left and right. I was trying to share with you a logical reason of how it came about. Now I'll take the, I'll check the, okay, we lost, okay. A very, let's see. So AD we got. Typological, okay, fine. Oh, typological, okay. I'm sorry about that. Hi, typological. Okay, that's a, okay. That's I learned something new today. Okay, typological, not typological. It's called a typo, sort of. That was a bad pun. Okay, that's the comments are fine. What did the Rambam do? The Rambam for sure took it literally. No, it's the Rishonim take Seder Olam literally. Why they do that? Are they aware of the truth and just sort of don't want to deal with it, or they really thought it historically? We'll have to have a discussion about that. Okay, we lost that week. We found that. Okay. Okay. Speaking of weddings, okay, if you want, I'll send a link to the live stream of the wedding. It's recorded. I'll put it on the chat if you want. I'll show the first chart again in a minute. Okay. And then, okay, the Purim comes. Okay, the Purim, this we have to dedicate a whole 2-3 shiurim on Purim based on this. Because how you understand Purim in the Megillah, tremendously affected by this, which is the deeper reason why the rabbis crunched the years. We'll see. I'm only beginning something. I think I'll give a much more convincing reason of why this became Jewish history and why it became accepted. But I need a lot more. We need to study Megillat Esther and a couple more books. There are now Jewish young earth enthusiasts. One second. That I didn't understand. Okay, Purim, that's right, comes at a completely different time. Okay, that's right. The Midrashim, okay. The Midrashim about Jerusalem, I'll take Ellie's question. If you remember Purim's story, everyone says that Darius was the son of Esther, because where do they put Ahasuerus? If Darius is Artaxasta, and after Artaxasta, there are no more Persian kings, the only place you could possibly put Xerxes or Ahasuerus is between Koresh and Daryavesh, which puts the Megillah before the Second Temple was built, which changes all the way we understand the Megillah. That'll be another reason why the rabbis did that. Again, we have to dedicate a whole shir to that. In about 2 or 3 weeks, we'll get there. I didn't understand what the unfortunate result of the new, now Jewish, young earth enthusiasts, I'm not sure what that has to do with anything.
I assume that means because the literal talk about the year is taken literally, so people believe 5781 is to creation. If we read in every ksuva,
that's a bigger problem. If I take Bereshit literally, I lost the book. You follow?
Right.
If I take the years in Sefer Bereshit literally, I missed the whole point of Sefer Bereshit, in my opinion. I think it's a disaster to take the creation story literally. I understand why, but if you take those years literally, you miss the whole beauty of Chumash and why we're chosen, but that's a topic for a different share.
Rabbi, if I may, because I don't see any other questions, I of course agree that it's a horrible thing to teach the Chumash literally, but I don't. How would you address the problem that clearly, listen, in the Haredi world, they ignore the problem. They just take it literally. And in the modern Orthodox world, I think it's the problem you raised, that maybe we don't teach it at a young enough age. Kids say, the Torah is not really true. The rabbis didn't know anything about history. The rabbis, made up stuff and they did whatever they want. I don't even know how to formulate the question, I guess, but how do we deal with that? And how can we, at least in our world, maintain the respect for, I know that's what you're trying to do, but I don't think any high schools do. I don't think the kid who comes to Yeshiva, the 18-year-old kid comes, he's already come with this negative attitude. The rabbis didn't really know anything about history, etc.
So when I have kids with that attitude problem, this shir helps them. Hopefully, I give the shir to teach them to respect Chazal's interpretation better. Now, if I have kids who are not, who accept it and haven't questioned anything, then why open up a Pandora's box? It scares them. So you have to be careful who you teach it to. But there's no doubt there's an educational dilemma. Now, there's the theological, that's one thing. There's an educational dilemma if you should teach this and who you teach it to and when you teach it. But there's a bigger danger not teaching it, because they're going to find out later on, they're going to put two and two together, realize that 420 doesn't make sense, and how could the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah be wrong? And then they'll start, and if they follow the outside history and are convinced by it, and they're convinced the rabbis are wrong, then they lose their faith in Chazal. I'm trying to give a logical reason why Chazal went in the direction they went into. And when we study Seder Olam in more detail, we'll see how beautiful Seder Olam is. But it's a different, that's why on that outline, I mentioned when you study Midrash, is the Midrash omniscient or is it thematic? What's the purpose of Midrash? And there's all different types of Midrashim, but Seder Olam is a Midrashic work. It's not giving you historical facts. It's giving exegetical interpretation with thematic, sometimes for thematic reasons, not necessarily for historical reasons.
But I'll follow up with two points. Number one, that's very nice you do that, but I don't think it's done in the modern Orthodox high schools in North America. I don't know in Israel, I'm not familiar at all, even here. I think, unfortunately, it's a little bit late. And then how would you apply this reasoning to biblical criticism? When should we be exposing modern Orthodox kids who are going to, at one point, hear about these things to biblical criticism? And I don't think any modern Orthodox school will teach anything about biblical criticism. Maybe I'm wrong if somebody knows, but I think they're afraid it with a 100-foot pole to go near that. But based on what you're saying, I mean, it's the exact same thing. Maybe for our generation, it's even much more important than the issue of dating, which is really, not such a... So what? So the dates are wrong. It's not at the core of our belief system. How might you address that, if I can ask?
First of all,
maybe it's unfair,
There's always the answer, but there's a need to tackle it. The easy thing is to ignore the question. That's minigamok. That's our custom. Now,
right, but it's not a good idea.
There's some really beautiful reasons. Rav Schwab once wrote that really the rabbis know the years, but they're hiding. So when Mashiach comes, they'll be caught by surprise, kind of things. There's a lot of Christianity stuff here because they use the years to calculate the birth of Christ. We didn't deal with the book of Daniel yet. But when we do Seder Olam, we see the book of Daniel is central in this. We're using the book of Daniel is going to support this, the rabbinic interpretation of crunching the years. Now, we'll have to understand what's shot in Daniel and what's the Midrashic interpretation of Daniel. But a lot of Daniel interpretation, it's a big argument between the rabbinic interpretation of Daniel and the Christian interpretation of Daniel. Because they're looking for anything. They're looking for predictions of the birth of their Messiah. And I can take Psukim and Daniel and understand one way, and it's very cryptic, Daniel. And therefore, the rabbis want to understand it one way to make sure we don't follow the Christian interpretation. But when we get to the book of Daniel, we'll deal with that. There's besides the what I call wishful thinking, there's a polemic with Christianity going on here as well, which is going to be one of the another reason why we're going to why Cedarlon is going to be accepted. Again, but that's for a polemic with Christianity as well, and that's a deeper topic.
Marty Lection's topic beginning Wednesday. Marty Lection will be starting 8 weeks on the Parshanut and polemics. Rashi, Ramban, even Radak, how Christian polemics with Christianity influence their Parshanut. So that's our first of our new series kicking off with this week Wednesday. So that, without even knowing it, you were plugging our series for Wednesday. I don't think he's not talking on biblical criticism. I don't think Rabbi Lection, but Dr. Lection, but it's more, the polemics. But I was just raising that. I mean, I know I will raise it with my students in chat, not in great depth, but I want them to know, because most of the kids are not observant to what I'm teaching, and they're going to go to university and they're going to hear about it. And I want them to hear about it from me first, that you can be aware of it and be a believing Jew. And I don't think that's done in any of the modern Orthodox schools. And I don't know if you want to, I mean, you see the brightest of the 18-year-olds. Yeah.
I'll give you the analogy I use but for teachers, is that what happens in Jewish education, I compare it to building a bridge. When you build a bridge, first you have to need the scaffolding to put the bridge up. You have to build the pillars. Now, so you need pillars, you need a bridge. But to build the pillars and the bridge, you need scaffolding. Now, to build something. Once the bridge is built, you can take the scaffolding down. Now, a midrashic interpretation that we grew up with, I call that the scaffolding. And what happens in Jewish education, we turn the scaffolding into pillars. And we assume that if I break down the scaffolding, I lose my Judaism, and therefore I'm going to believe in the scaffolds instead of in the pillar. In other words, instead of the pillars becoming my pillars of belief, the scaffolding becomes the pillar of my belief. And I only needed the scaffolding to build the pillar, but once the pillar's up, I can take the scaffolding down. So the simplistic interpretation, simplistic ways of simply dating things like that, I see that as scaffolding, not as pillars. But sometimes it turns into dogma. The scaffolding turns into dogma about that. That's how there's certain things, we take the Torah. When you do Hagbah, that's exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu got in Har Sinai. That's very good for young children to give them emunah and belief. Is it historically true? There's lots of different opinions. But when you turn that belief, that simplistic understanding and dogma, into a pillar instead of scaffolding, that's when you run into a problem. And then you spend your whole time in education believing in the scaffolding instead of understanding the pillars.
Okay, I know it's late, but the real problem is the leaders in our world. That's what they're doing. It's not from the mid-level. In other words, that's coming from the top down. In other words, look at the reaction, when you just hit the third rail, that the Torah is not exactly the same that Moshe Rabbeinu got. I mean, you say that, I don't have a problem with that, of course. And anybody who's read Mark Shapiro's book and knows all the sources and traditional sources, but you say that even in some modern Orthodox school or in, they'll throw you out.
No, because they don't, you're not saying the Torah is not from God. There's everything the Torah.
I know what we're saying. I'm just saying, yeah. I think modern Orthodox kids are afraid to speak. Whenever we're having a discussion actually over Shabbos, that schools do a very good job of blunting the curiosity of kids. Young kids ask all these questions, and the Jewish schools sometimes do a good job of not allowing certain questions to come up because they're too dangerous. The teachers, many of them, don't know how to answer them. You have to know a lot. You have to be quite sophisticated to answer these questions. And I don't know, I'm just raising the issue. I don't have a solution. If anybody would like to, suggest something, I teach different style of kids. Rabbi Lieftag teaches, whatever, but...
That's why one good approach is send your kid to a Haredi school and he won't have these questions.
But it can't work for us because that. I mean, it's a half joke, but believe me, in the Haredi school, they got their other problems because the kids who do discover it, the disconnect is worse. In other words, when a Haredi kid, that when the modern kid goes off the derech, or not, because it goes off the derech a little bit often. When the Haredi kids go off the derech, it's usually more. They'll eat on Yom Kippur because
I'll give you another analogy. I call it insulation as opposed to inoculation. Hmm. When I'm teaching, do I try to insulate them from outside knowledge or inoculate them so they'll be able to survive it? And most of Haredi education is insulation. And now it's not just insulation, it's protecting the insulation. Almost the whole religion becomes protecting the insulation. And protecting the insulation became basically a religion. And therefore, don't go to college, don't read this, don't open that. keep it simple and thing, and have what's called emunah tamima. And I understand that approach because it works. But if you're going to go to college, it's a different ballgame.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's why open up a Pandora's box? You don't need to. With our kids, we don't. We're trying to play both games, and you can't. It's got to be one or the other. So you can take it head on. You can open up. Then you have to inoculate them and know how to deal with these questions and how to build emunat chachamim and understand when chachamim makes statements where it's coming from.
So I think that's exactly our problem. I think that's the problem. The modern Orthodox world, we want to expose our kids, but we don't do a good enough job inoculating them, giving them, quote unquote, a vaccine that isn't dangerous. It's okay to be open to this stuff. I think that's, how do we solve that? I don't know, but I've said enough. If anybody else wants to say something,
okay. Can I have one quick comment? There's a book by Rav Amnon Bazak to this very day.
Correct.
It goes in great detail on Bible criticism. Maybe you can get him to speak once about it.
Amnon Bazak has spoken a couple times for us in Hebrew, and when Rabbi Liebtag can convince him to speak again, he's very busy. He tells me he's very busy. If Rabbi Liebtag asks him on my behalf, maybe he'll be a little bit less busy. But I read Adayom Hazeh in Hebrew. He also has another fantastic book on Torah Shebaal Peh.
They both, but it's translated into.
Yes, Koren just translated into English. I'll tell you, the other book is Josh Berman. I was mentioning, for those who were on earlier today, we do every few weeks, we do a program for basically college students, small group of college students with an author. So this morning we had Aviva Klumpis, who was the speech writer for Ron Professor when they was in the UN. She wrote all the speeches. And in 3 weeks, Josh Berman is going to speak. So Josh Berman wrote the book Animamim in English. He deals head on with the issues of biblical criticism. I mean, there are some people dealing with it, but it's not mainstream. And maybe for many kids, it is not good to bring it up. I don't know. It's a hard problem. I'm just saying, in the modern Orthodox world where we do expose our kids to everything, you know, we have to grapple with the issue and how to do it. And I struggle with this issue. It's not a simple issue.
That's an educational dilemma for sure.